Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday morning. It is the 17th of March, and we welcome you. We wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day, and we are most pleased to present a wonderful panel this morning. Great people who are on to talk to us about the issues of the day. Let me introduce them. Before I do, real quick, let me just remind you that you can be a part of the program. We would love for you to be a part of the program. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And that's all you have to do is write to us, and we'll consider your letter. We get a lot more than we can read, but we do our best. Panel@WAMC.org. All right. Let us welcome the group. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you, Joe. I know how important it is. And you know what's interesting is St. Patrick's Day has become, you know, really a national holiday for everybody. Roselle's walking around with a green skirt on today, and a lot of people take it seriously. And while we're on the subject, a historical shout out to Ben Briscoe and his father, Robert Briscoe, for their contribution to Dublin.
Okay, should I know what that is? Because I don't.
They were the Jewish Lord Mayors of...
Okay, all right, now I got it.
See what I mean by universal?
Yes, it is universal. Yeah. Got it. Very, very cool. Let's see, we want to welcome investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. How are you?
I am well. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning. You seem a little subdued this morning.
I as my mother says, we're Italian. Why are we celebrating this? But my sister has one answer for her, and beer.
Yeah, beer. Beer or Irish whiskey. I will say that people often, because like, I'm wearing jeans and a blue shirt, and people say, well, you know, why are you wearing green? And I said, you know, I've been wearing the name Joseph Christopher Francis Donahue my entire life. I think I'm wearing plenty of Irish. I don't know what more you can do than that, quite frankly. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill is with us. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
Very nice to have you here. And. Yeah. Chief of...
You don't sound convinced, Chris.
This is how that went. Very nice to have you here. Yeah.
I meant to convey more enthusiasm than that. Yeah. I just got a little distracted for a second.
I guess it's okay. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I have to say I enjoyed that fiddle interlude that brought us onto the air this morning.
Yeah, a little reel.
I don't know the difference between a jig or a reel, but I assume it was one of those things.
I believe those were reels that we heard, yes. And I just want to say that there was a great Irish-American rock group by the name of Black 47. And the frontman of that group will be with us in our 11 o'clock hour, Larry Kerwin. And very excited about that. So that's coming up. That's how we'll celebrate the holiday this morning here on the show. Let's get started with the news of the day. Oh, I want to make a mention of something while we're talking about Lord Mayors and the like. Virginia Hodson has been a devoted listener for many, many years to this program. And it is her 90th birthday today. Virginia turns 90 today. Her granddaughter, Nicolette, wrote us a letter about a month ago asking us if we could mention her birthday today, and we said yes, and goodness, we actually remembered. So Virginia Hodson is 90 today, and we wish her a very, very happy birthday.
That's wonderful. Yeah, really wonderful.
Really great. A wonderful listener, a devoted listener for many, many years. And we love Virginia, and we wish her a very happy 90th birthday today. All right, let's get started with what is going on, and there is a lot of it, so let's talk. Well, I wasn't going to start with this story, and then I keep on saying I'm not going to start with this story, and then there's some other little twist that makes me have to start with the story. So let's talk about the Cuomo affair here, and that is the latest being what we just heard in the newscast coming in with the President of the United States weighing in on this and saying that if these allegations prove to be true, then yes, the governor should resign and be prosecuted, I believe, was what the president said. also, there is so that is one thing, and then there is also a story in the New York Times this morning as to some of the initial reaction from the governor's office as this started to break loose, and as the story started to get out into the press, of some of the tactics that the governor's office was using to tarnish the accusers. And the headline of the article is how Cuomo's team tried to tarnish one of his accusers. People tied to Governor Andrew Cuomo sought to damage the credibility of Lindsay Boylan, the first woman to accuse Mr. Cuomo of sexual harassment. So there is that story as well. But let's start, Alan, with the president. And we talked a little bit about this yesterday. The two are close. They're political allies, but they're also friends. So what do you make of the president's remarks?
First of all, I'd like to say, et tu, Brute, you know, this is bad news for Cuomo, no question about it. Now, he has told me a number of times that he and the president are quite close. In fact, at one point he was talking to me and he said that they sort of did odds and evens about which of them would run for president.
Yeah.
So, and that in fact, you know, he Andrew Cuomo stood aside. So if they are to, if he is to be believed, they are tight. And as you just mentioned, they supposed to be friends. On the other hand, I think Biden took a look at the situation and I think he spoke out and he said, look, if the investigation proves to be right, then, you know, he has to go. But the second part of that is not only does he have to go, but the first time I've heard, and he'll probably be prosecuted. So that's a huge advance coming from the president of the United States.
Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I mean, it is something that Biden spoke about it, although I think what he said was pretty obvious. I mean, if the allegations are proven to be true or shown to be true in the report by Attorney General Tish James, then, I mean, of course Cuomo would have to resign, and of course he might face criminal prosecution. I mean, one of the allegations, if it's not a sexual assault, becomes very, very close, right? So, I mean, it would be inconceivable that if the Tish James report confirms that the governor could somehow hold on to his office. I mean, I think at that point the pressure would be overwhelming. But you know, I think part of the backstory too is that at this point the only person who probably could convince Cuomo to resign probably is Joe Biden. I think other than him stepping in, I think Cuomo will hang on for as long as he possibly can.
Which seems to be the roadmap here now, given the president weighing it down. He probably won't go back at this point, right? Wouldn't change his mind, in other words.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine so. I mean, unless, of course, more women come forward with more allegations or we learn something else.
Rosemary Arameo.
Yeah, I sort of agree with Chris on this. His real danger, Cuomo's real danger, is coming from that investigation. Tish James has put two pit bulls onto the case. The law firm that will be working for the legislature is it's hard. He has to convince them, not the people of America or Joe Biden. I don't think Biden said anything that you know, isn't obvious and true. And I'm also not terribly surprised or disturbed to hear that his allies, who seem to be dwindling in number, were calling around trying to dig up dirt. They did it rather ham-handedly. You're not supposed to be caught doing that sort of thing. But it certainly is not unexpected that you're trying to slam at least one of the people making allegations against you. It's not a good look for him. And I'm very interested, maybe you all who know more about state government can tell me, about this leak of the transcript or the goings on at the Democratic conference at which Carl Hastings is all upset about it, at which they discussed possibly impeaching Cuomo. What do you think of that?
That's a really good question. This is where this is when they were talking about, they were debating, the assembly was debating whether, of how they should go forward, and they were wrangling over this, and then the audio was leaked, and Carl Hastie has been quite outspoken, very upset that this has taken place, and what was to be a private conversation and was not. Alan, what are your thoughts on that?
Surprise.
And then I'll get to you, Malia, I promise. Yeah, go ahead.
Surprise, surprise. When you meet, and a lot of legislators meet together, somebody is going to leak, have a cell phone on and leak it? Wow. I mean, wouldn't Speaker Hastie have to be a little bit naive if he really means that he's surprised that that happened? That's a question.
Yeah. Well, and then also the fact that one lawmaker said of Hastie's apparent reaction to the news story, government was shut down. He came out onto the floor in the middle of voting and said the session is done. So I don't know exactly how all that works, but he stopped the vote after Yahoo News reached out to him for comment on a story based on the audio of the March 11th meeting about Cuomo. And in that meeting, the Democratic conference discussed whether to impeach the governor in response to multiple allegations of sexual misconduct and an alleged cover-up of nursing home deaths during the early days of the coronavirus pandemic. Rosemary, I'm glad you brought this up, because it is fascinating, because we sort of know what happened, right? I mean, it's not like we know how that story ended.
Right. I all of this, it's everything is transparent. He has enough enemies that any move he makes is going to be telegraphed to the rest of the world. Anything his supposed allies, other Democrats, say about him is going to go out. He really is having a miserable time right now, I suspect.
Malia.
Well, to get back to the Biden statement, I think what's notable about it is that Biden is essentially coming out in favor of due process, which, as the other panelists have pointed out, is not surprising. But let's keep in mind, there are a lot of Democrats who have called for Cuomo to resign now. And I think Biden is pointedly not doing that. And so, in a way, I think it's support for the due process.
Mm. Well, you know, it started by Cuomo wanting, Malia, Cuomo wanting to have this extra time, right? Because he was in a really bad spot. So what he said was, let's turn this over to the Attorney General for investigation. Because clearly that was in his interest. Otherwise, the pressure to resign was going to be too great. But when the president of the United States not only comes out and says, if the report is negative, but then uses the P word, prosecution, that's quite something, I think.
This is something I want to, Chris, we have just a few minutes, and I'll have you weigh on, and then we'll go to the rest of the group, too, on this. But it seems that you have dual stories here. Not only is the investigation including the charges of sexual harassment and in one case sexual assault, but also the nursing home issue, which is a very big issue.
Yeah, and that one is essentially proven. We can talk about due process when it comes to the sexual harassment allegations, but you know the nursing home side of it, I think it's well documented what they did. They've essentially conceded what they did, and you know, actually, when it comes to sexual harassment, too, some of the things that the governor has somewhat admitted to are kind of textbook sexual harassment. The kind of banter that as he described it, you know, under the state's own rules and regulations is classic sexual harassment.
Well,
the nursing home side of it shouldn't be forgotten. I mean, that is a, you know, there are two or three different scandals brewing here, and the nursing home one is a big deal. I mean, the FBI and the Attorney General's office, not the Attorney General's office, the U.S. Attorney's office are both said to be looking at it, so that shouldn't be underestimated.
Alan?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, Melissa DeRosa, unless I'm missing this, and somebody on the panel will know the answer to this. Melissa DeRosa, the top person in the Cuomo administration other than Cuomo, who was very vocal for a long time, has not been heard from. Chris, is that right? And we haven't heard from her. She's been silent, and she basically let the cookies out of the cookie cutter, and said, "Yeah, you know, this business about." She confirmed the nursing home issue. So is it?
She was the aide who was calling around trying to get dirt on one of the accusers as well.
Oh, is that right?
I'm not surprised that we're not hearing from her right now.
She has not tweeted in over a week, which she was tweeting regularly.
Not only tweeted, but you know, she was pretty front and center for a long time, but I think she's pretty quiet right now.
Well, and even the governor is quiet right now, right? I mean, we certainly aren't getting the briefings. There are some, if there are events, they are closed events. But that's to be expected, I would think, right? I mean, I don't know. It'd be hard to do the other, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's not hard. I mean, but he could do it. He just doesn't want to be asked these questions, right?
Right.
Because they're, you know, he had that press conference last week, which I thought was pretty disastrous, and it probably raised more questions than it answered. And, you know, I think you'd probably like to avoid those scenarios.
Well, I can think of is when Andrew became the governor and was becoming the governor, his father appeared with him and put his hand on Andrew's cheek and said, "He's a good boy." I thought that was very interesting, very telling. He's a good boy.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, that's certainly up for debate, I think.
We'll see. The president is waiting. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot to talk about this morning, and we will do so. We welcome your letters, as always. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome you. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Malia Dumont on the panel this morning. We'll be back right after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Malia Dumont, and Chris Churchill. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we, let's see. Julius writes and says, "Don't forget the defective bolts on the bridge." Chris, your newspaper broke that story, I believe. Am I correct on that?
That is correct. Yeah, that's another scandal. Yeah. they add up.
But that also is, but I mean, not only is that, I don't know, well, you would know this better than I. I'll ask you and Rosemary this question of what makes a scandal a scandal. Is that a scandal?
Well, it could potentially be. I mean, if the governor knew something about the safety of the bridge and then went ahead and, you know, opened it and, you know, declined to say anything about potential safety concerns, I think that certainly qualifies as a scandal. And, you know, and that might be one, you know, we talked earlier about the nursing home scandal. And while I think it's very serious and very damaging to the governor, I do think it's one that's a little bit complicated to explain to people sometimes. But I think people really intuitively understand sexual harassment because a lot of women have obviously experienced it in the workplace and have been, you know, approached by, you know, creeps. And I think people understand, you know, about what it means to travel over a bridge that might not be safe. So, you know, in some ways, I think even though the nursing home scandal is about, you know, deaths of senior citizens, I think the bridge and sexual harassment ones are probably more damaging to them.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I agree. I think the bridge story is, in a way, it's being underplayed right now because of the shadow of the other scandals that Chris has mentioned. The worst part of it is not that there were defective bolts, but that people knew about it, that the ones who knew about it were you know, just silenced, and that there was not transparency, that there may not have been state inspections. And, of course, we know that Cuomo was very much in favor of pushing this bridge, rode across it in a fancy old automobile named the bridge after his father. It's definitely not a good look, and it's, I think, extremely serious if it turns out First of all, there's not even an investigation underway right now to ensure that it's safe. That has been called for, but it hasn't been granted that I'm aware of. So that makes me a little bit nervous. And then if there is a problem, if the investigation proves that there is a danger, the replacing every bolt on a bridge of that size, oh, my God, the cost is enormous at a time when what is our deficit? We don't even have a complete handle on it. So, I think it's pretty major.
And oh, the traffic. Alan, your thoughts on that?
What did he know and when did he know it?
Yeah.
I think Chris is right about that. That's what it's all about. If it just turns out that there were defective bolts, terrible, terrible means he and people who work for him weren't doing a good job. But if it turns out.
Can I just point out, it's also not the only bridge in New York that has problems. So I live in Kingston, and from my house, I can see the Wart Street Bridge, which was made semi-famous in the recent HBO show, The Undoing, where the finale took place.
Yep.
And that bridge, which is historically important, was built in 1921, and it was the bridge that allowed traffic to go continuously from right by New York City all the way to Albany. And it's been closed now for months and months because I think actually it was something like bolts falling out. I don't remember the details, but I'm sure there are other bridges like that around the state where the funding isn't there or the maintenance hasn't been done. And it's a big problem for our local infrastructure.
And, not only around the state, but in here in Great Barrington, we have several bridges that have been closed down. And, that's very tough because Great Barrington, as you probably all know, is on Route 7. Route 7 runs through it, and Route 7 is a major route from south to north or north to south. So, this infrastructure thing really has come to a crisis level around the country.
Also, I have an unreasonable fear of bridges anyway, so I hate these stories
too.
So much. Let me read this letter from Maxine. The subject line is boring BS. Get ready. Hopefully you can find someone other than Cuomo to talk and gossip about. It is boring, and so are your observations. Yes, boring, and you are rehashing and composing gossip as you go along. We hear you filling time, our time. Wait for the legal process to take place. Stop wasting your time and ours. Why not bring back Trump, the rump, and bad talk about that dirtbag? Dare you to read this letter. That's the only reason I read it.
Well, you took the dare.
Yeah, I took the dare.
But I have to say, New York is not the only one who are playing the Cuomo story. It's being played around the world.
It's a national story, an international
story.
Right.
That's right. It's on every major broadcast. So I understand the frustration of the letter writers who have made this point, but it's a big story.
The other thing.
Well, frankly, that letter is absurd. I mean, the president of the United States yesterday said that the governor should resign if the allegations are true and that he should be prosecuted. I mean, that is a story. You may like Cuomo and maybe you don't want your guy to be talked about negatively, but sorry, it's a story. Just as, we got similar letters when the news was bad about Trump and we were talking about it. We get letters from Trump supporters saying, stop talking about it. Well, no, these are news stories. These are important things. And, the other story, which we were talking about, the idea that they were smearing Lindsay Boylan for coming forward with allegations, that's a serious story. I mean, these are important things that speak to the character of the governor of the state of New York, and obviously they should be talked about.
Rosemary?
I sympathize with the letter writer in being – again, oh my God, we have to go again on more stories about sex scandals involving high-level politicians. The answer, however, is not the news media to stop writing about them. It's for better behavior by our politicians. And that will require action by voters. So step up.
Are you still in Virginia, by the way?
I am. Can you tell?
No. Yeah, well, you have a little bit of a Southern accent, but the follow-up question was, what's the story like, Rosemary? The question is it getting play down there?
Oh, yeah. Don't forget, Virginia is a place where their governor also had a few problems with scandal and bad behavior in his past, and he weathered it. So, they're definitely listening to it here, talking about it.
Well, I mean, in the Washington Post is breaking stories on this, which obviously was a large coverage area in Virginia. I don't know whether you were in the north or south part of the state, Rosemary, but...
South.
Oh, okay. So let us go to this letter. This is from Nancy. Biden just played the safety card. What he said is obvious. God himself could tell Cuomo to resign and he would still not. Also, if the law is zero tolerance on sexual harassment in the workplace, then he is out, period. According to this law, it doesn't matter if he touched them, groped them, creeped them out. He was inappropriate and no one denies it. This should not take very long. Then we go to Liz. I go back to my initial thoughts in the beginning. There are more people and stories about Andy and his tough guy abusive behaviors. Victims have been victimized in the past, and I understand their silence. Now people are leaking information. I believe everyone is entitled to due process and is innocent until proven guilty. But Andrew knows what he has done, and he needs to dig deep and do the right thing. It's never too late to make a good decision. Stop torturing us with your long-time bad behavior. It distracts the Democrats from taking care of all important issues at hand, which we have talked a lot about that, of whether it does or it doesn't. Go ahead, Alan.
I'm sorry, Joe, for interrupting. But are we sure he knows what he's done that's wrong? You know, some people who do bad things don't know it. They compensate for it one way or another. It's a whole psychological process.
Right. You're right. Trisha says, I tuned in this morning hoping you would begin with a topic other than Cuomo. I'm taking a hiatus and we'll be back when you can focus on other issues. This is so interesting to me. I remember us talking about this with Trump, too, that people would get upset. But it's the governor of the Empire State who is under investigation and is the subject of an impeachment investigation. I don't know how you don't talk about that. But maybe that's just
And is also being investigated by the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office. Right. I mean, there's three or four different investigations happening simultaneously.
Yeah, I don't think we should not talk about it, but I was surprised that it was the first thing, simply because it's only been an incremental change between today and yesterday, whereas some of the national stories happening are huge and different, and we've not talked about them before. So I get it.
Okay.
Yeah, I sympathize with those writers to a certain extent, too. I think that there's the stories, statements are made, investigations are going on. And then there's all the speculative, to use the term that the first letter writer used, gossip around that.
Oh,
and
I thought you were going to say BS. So, I was worried.
But either way, maybe we should do those letter writers a favor and... I'm not sure if there's much more there's no more facts to share about this at this point, right?
Well, the big fact today was the president. The big fact today was the president of the United States. That was huge.
Right. And again, I don't think that report that the Cuomo administration was attempting to smear one of the women who came forward is unimportant either. I mean, people always ask people who are skeptical of these sort of allegations, I always ask, well, why didn't these women come forward earlier? Why didn't they come forward earlier? Why are they coming forward now? And this is exactly the reason. The Cuomo administration has used intimidation and force and bullying to silence people on a whole lot of things for a long time. And you know, the fact that they're being called to account for it now, I think, is important. You know, this is an administration that has a lot of trouble releasing public information when it comes to bridges or nursing home deaths, but somehow has no trouble at all releasing people's personnel files when those people cross the governor. I think that's an interesting, you know, little thing to note.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about something else. You've shamed us into it. We'll do that right after this quick break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Wednesday morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Malia Dumont making up the panel. Your letters at panel@wamc.org. President Biden for the first time said he favored a return to the requirement that opponents occupy the floor when making their case against legislation. Senator Mitch McConnell promised a scorched earth response with Biden's endorsing filibuster rule changes. The fight over the Senate filibuster escalated sharply on Tuesday. as President Biden for the first time threw his weight behind changing the rules, even as Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, threatened harsh reprisals if Democrats moved to weaken the procedural tactic. In an interview with ABC News, Mr. Biden gave his most direct endorsement yet of overhauling the filibuster, saying that he favored a return to what is called the talking filibuster, the requirement that opponents of legislation occupy the floor and make their case against it. Currently, senators need only to register their objections to legislation to force supporters to produce 60 votes to break the filibuster, which has become a near daily part of Senate life. Requiring opponents to hold the floor would put more of the burden on them and theoretically make it harder for them to sustain their opposition. That from the New York Times. Alan.
Mr. Smith goes to Washington. How many of us will forget that, standing
that
up
movie.
There
yes.
and carrying on the way, you know, in order to put a stop to something? You know, I'm a huge Biden fan, and unlike others, even on this panel, I have great faith in the guy. And, you know, he stayed in the Senate for all of these years. He knows his stuff, and I'm willing to follow him on this. The big question is, if the Republicans win the Senate, which they may well do in, you know, in the next election, which is right around the corner, then you've got a real problem because they are the big beneficiaries of the change in the rules, and a simple majority will allow them to do it. But if Biden says that's the way to go, hey, I'm willing.
Rosemary.
I think the most amazing part of the story is the absolute bald, mean threat from Mitch McConnell.
Yep.
Not as if we didn't know it, but now he's saying it out loud. I think he's perfectly capable of just stopping the Senate dead. I think Ron Johnson proved what they could do when he had them read the 600-page stimulus bill, which took up, you know, more than a day in working hours. And I think you'd see a whole lot more of that. So his threat is not to be taken lightly, but I think he should be punished in some way for it. And my inclination in reading about this, I have a class working on this, you know, what is the filibuster and how did it come to be and how does it work? And my inclination that right now, I can be persuaded otherwise, is for the Democrats to go back. I'd pull it all together, but to go back at least to making it harder to do is not a bad idea. And if it stops legislation, that's important. It's also legislation that's extremely popular in the United States. And so that will make Republicans unpopular with Americans. So I like that. On the other hand, and what gives me pause, is that if the Democrats don't get the voting rights bill through, the restrictions on voting being put into place by Republican legislatures around the country means Democrats aren't going to get another shot at this. They will not get into office easily again. So this is an extremely serious, pull for naked power by the Republicans. And I think Democrats must respond bravely.
Chris.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do think the rules, there's a need for reform. I don't know, you know, as Alan alluded to, you have to be a little bit careful because, you know, the balance of power will shift someday, and whatever changes are made now will affect Democrats going forward. So, but it is obviously we've reached a point where nothing can get done. You know, in some sense it's Mitch McConnell's job to try to block some of the things that Biden wants to do, just as it was Chuck Schumer's job to block the things that Trump wanted to do. But I think the opposition at this point has too much ability to. It's undemocratic to have that much power to stop legislation that that the majority of voters approve of.
You know, Chris, I agree with most of what you just said, except when you said nothing got done. You just got a $1.9 trillion.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not true that nothing got done. I mean, There are plenty of things that don't get done.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Malia, what do you think?
Well, Senator McConnell is a master tactician, and of course, this is a key tool in his box. So it's unsurprising, as Rosemary said, that he's going to try to fight tooth and nail to keep it. But as the president himself said, this is not eliminating the filibuster. It's, I think, eliminating the ability to abuse the filibuster to bring the Senate to a standstill. So the filibuster will still exist in its previous incarnation, which protected the rights of the minority. So I hope that this rule change is able to go through.
What is I'm curious, Rosemary. You said you have your class looking at this, but when it comes to the filibuster, just talk a little bit about how we got where we are and why this is such a big deal. And I'm just curious also as to what a scorched earth response would be like.
Yeah, I find it really threatening, and no one knows the rules of the Senate so well as Mitch McConnell, and he's absolutely, you know, has no qualms about using them to just stop action dead, one procedural rule after another. For one thing, the Senate operates by consent to break the rules that exist. And so he said, I'll pull that. You can't even turn the lights on after noon, before noon, if we don't agree to it. So nothing would be agreed to. Any procedure, you'd have to read it. You'd have to go back. Oh, it's just unending what he could do. It really would just stop the body dead.
So the question,
and how did we get into the again, actually, with a really great idea, which is that a majority should not be able to railroad a minority into something, especially on important matters. There should be more of an effort to get to persuade, to talk to each other, to compromise, to get to a place where you can get 60 votes. But that has been it was used, of course, a good idea used in a bad way, and that was to help the Jim Crow senators keep restrictions on blacks after the Civil War and in the Civil Rights era. And that's what it was initially put into place for. But it did work for a really long time in the Biden years. What he remembers from in the Senate, people actually did try to compromise and come together and find candidates for the Supreme Court that everyone could agree to. And then there's the Mitch McConnell age. And because he knows the rules so well, he has used that rule as a weapon. And he has consistently done that. And Harry Reid, I know Alan always says Harry Reid started this, but he didn't. Harry Reid was provoked by McConnell, who refused to let any appointees through. He was provoked into modifying the rule. And so then he even makes it easier, because now you don't have to talk and use up the time. You just have to register your dissatisfaction with the bill. And it registers as a filibuster. We don't have the 60 votes, therefore the bill is dead. And it's easy. It's easy. And so what we've ended up with is the minority railroading the majority. And that's why reform is needed.
Alan.
Well, the question is, what is McConnell so scared of? It's clear that he has now gone ballistic, which means that he is afraid of something himself, which brings him to this point where he does this stuff. So what's going on with McConnell that makes him so frightened?
Malia? You want to take that one? You don't have to.
I mean, the full range of the Biden administration's plans. I mean, I'm sure that McConnell, it's just so easy, as Rosemary said, to register objections now. Anything that Biden would want to do. So pretty much anything on the Biden agenda, I would think, is what McConnell is
I don't know. I
thinking
think
he's about to lose the ability to oppose.
I don't know. I think that something really set him off, and he's frightened about something here. Well, you know, and also he knows that he has a shot. Maybe he doesn't know that. Maybe the real question is, does McConnell think that they can take the Senate? And we should discuss that, because so many people are resigning. So many Republicans are getting out.
Right.
Now, one would think that that could either, I'm sorry to do this to you guys, but that could either work for or against you. if, in fact, some of the more unpopular guys are getting out and more popular people will run for those offices on the Republican side, you know, it may be good for McConnell. But on the other hand, it may be bad if a lot of these people are getting off the ship as fast as they can. It may indicate that they don't think they have a shot at taking the Senate. And then you would understand why McConnell is so frightened of this.
Chris?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think McConnell is, like a lot of politicians, is mostly about maintaining as much power as he can maintain. And, you know, this is a threat to his power. I think that explains a lot of it. You know, I think he would probably go into 2020, into the next election cycle, thinking that he will gain seats. I mean, typically the opposition party does. Right. Our politics are a little unsettled right now, so to say the least. So I don't know that we can necessarily
hard to predict.
Yeah, sometimes historical examples are no longer relevant, you know. But traditionally, the opposition party does take seats.
That's right.
On the other hand, Biden's popularity right now is through the roof. So.
Yep.
You know, if he can even come close to maintaining that, the Democrats could be in pretty good shape.
About a minute. Go ahead, Alan.
We've had letters from people who have indicated, you know, chapter and verse, the times that the party out of power, the presidential power, does gain seats, despite the, you're quite correct, Chris, that usually it goes the other way. It goes against the president's party. But you never know.
All right.
I think so.
Okay.
Okay.
So if here's what McConnell is afraid of. That's not going to happen if the voting rights bill, H.R. 1, gets through.
If
all of the efforts, the huge effort underway to change election laws throughout Republican control states, that goes away. It becomes easy and fast for people to vote. And that usually helps Democrats.
Great
and
point.
He already knows that. It's usual that an incumbent president gets reelected, too. That didn't happen because, as Chris says, our politics are in turmoil right now. So I believe that to maintain control over the Senate, which is now and has always been the sine qua non of our minority leader, he needs to make sure that bill does not go through. It will never go through if there's a filibuster. It does not have 60 votes, but it does have a majority of votes with the Democrats. And that, I believe, is his main effort. And he's using every trick. He has threats to Democrats, calling up the illusion of destroying the institution of the Senate. The Senate is destroyed. It is not working right now. Has not worked for some time. Not saying that. You're seeing a master politician with what are really bad motives at work in Mitch McConnell's methods right now. And it's all to maintain his power.
All right, we have to pause there. We have to take a break. We are late. We will go to a break and we'll return First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Malia Dumont, and Chris Churchill. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a number of letters talking about the filibuster, so I want to get to those. And here we go. As soon as I get them locked and loaded, as it were. All right, we go to Mike. The filibuster was invented to protect slavery. We need to remember that. It's time to get rid of it altogether. Any good it may have done in the past, it is now a tool of total obstruction. Then there is Robert, who says, your panel only seems to be interested in preserving or removing the filibuster as it affects the Democrats' ability to pass legislation. You're ignoring the over-the-top statements made by Biden and others in recent years championing the filibuster when they were in the minority. What could be more hypocritical? Who would like to take that?
Republicans have any trouble passing laws at all. And there is some hypocrisy involved in here, and that is because the people, the Democrats themselves, led by Biden, are feeling conflicted about it. They understand the good intentions and the possibilities of using the filibuster when it's applied correctly. It is not being applied correctly now, and so then they are reluctantly and dragging their feet talking about how to reform it or to do away with it. So it's not hypocrisy. It's a change in the use of the filibuster that has occasioned a new look at it.
Alan?
Well, we've been over this a number of times. I think that those people who are opposed to the concept of democracy, meaning the majority vote, are always going to be, you know, pro-filibuster, no question. Now, some Democrats and some liberals and some other people say there's a good reason for that. We can show you in history, and I'm sure Rosemary could give us those, reasons for having a filibuster to stop something onerous from happening. And so it's a tough one, but I myself am for getting rid of it. I think democracy is democracy from the people, demos, from the people. And, you know, this is not a good way for us to be going.
Malia?
Well, I think before the rule was changed to allow people to just register a filibuster by objection, it actually was a useful tool in some instances, as I said before, to protect the right of the minority. And so I'm not as familiar with all the details of how the filibuster works as some of the other members of the panel, but I'm not so sure that we need to entirely get rid of it.
Chris,
why?
Okay, go with that.
As I said, when it's not abused, when it's a little bit harder to use, but it's still there in case of emergency. You know, the minority can register their objections in person, and you know, cause a delay where people have to think more deeply and consider what the actual objections are.
So just wait.
And maybe if they have to take the floor, then they'd be forced to actually talk about what the objections are instead of just, you know, mailing it in literally, which is what they've been doing recently.
So, Malia, just wait until the show-offs, the Hawleys and the other guys decide this is a great way to grab the spotlight. And going back to the old way, they will. And we know who those folks are. So I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just simply saying that's a good way to sort of examine what the potential for danger is here.
Let's go to some more letters. Mark says, Rosemary is right. McConnell is afraid of H.R. 1 and H.R. 4. Michael says McConnell is angry, starting with losing Georgia Senate runoffs, which he blames Trump on since it makes his obstructionist politics much harder. We saw him uncharacteristically lash out at Trump following the second impeachment acquittal. Now the president indicates he's willing to weaken him further with the much-needed changes to the filibuster. I hope Democrats shine light on the obstructionist politics and win more Senate seats in 2022. Ricky says, make the senators talk in order to use the filibuster. Isn't that what the filibuster is? When did the rules change to make it possible to filibuster without having to talk and talk and talk? Philip says, the fact is that whether or not Dems reform the filibuster now, the autocratic Mitch will alter it himself the first chance he gets when he has the opportunity. If he believes circumstances call for it, and he'll lie and say what that time is supposedly different than this time, as he did with Merrick Garland and Amy Coney Barrett. Joyce says, if the filibuster is not...
Absolute. That's so absolute. Can I just...
Absolutely.
That's so absolutely true, and it's one of the reasons that I just laugh anytime a GOP sympathizer asks about hypocrisy. We have learned from the best. He is arguing this way now because it helps his side. And if he got into power again as the majority leader, it would not help his side. And so he would not argue it. And that is the height of it. It's deeper than hypocrisy. It's the worst kind of cynicism. It's the use of anything you can to keep power.
We go to Joyce, who says that the filibuster has not changed. Democrats have no chance to keep the Senate because of voter suppression. The Voting Rights Act must be passed if the Democrats can maintain power.
How does anybody see that happening? I mean, you got a Senate, you got a 50-50 split, and you know that the Republicans are going to be absolutely united in making sure that that redress doesn't happen, that H.R. 1 and the rest don't pass, because they're done for. So I don't see how, when the letter writer is quite right, it should be passed, no question about that. But how do you get it through?
Good question. Anyone else? All right, we'll leave it rhetorical for the moment, if that's okay. Kevin says, no one person, not Mitch McConnell, Joe Manchin, Susan Collins, should hold so much, quote unquote, power in our deliberative legislative body or a Trump-like executive.
To which I say, and you've all heard it before, should schmud. So, you know, absolutely right. So it's right. That shouldn't happen. But it does happen, and it is happening, and that's the way it is.
All right, let's move on to other things on this morning, and we go to let's talk about the stimulus and the Republican attorneys general threatening key elements of the $1.9 trillion stimulus package. The GOP officials are asking the Biden administration to clarify $350 billion in programs to help cities, counties, and states in financial need. 21 Republican state attorneys general on Tuesday threatened to take action against the Biden administration over its new $1.9 trillion stimulus law, decrying it for imposing, quote, unprecedented and unconstitutional, end quote, limits on their state's ability to lower taxes. The letter marks one of the first major political and legal salvos against the relief package since President Biden signed it last week. Amidst the sustained Republican opposition that the White House faces as it implements the signature element of the president's economic policy agenda. Alan.
Well, you know, it could be very difficult for the Democrats. Look, these guys are going to attack it. The Republicans are going to attack it on every level that they possibly can. Some of it may actually go to the Supreme Court of the United States, and we know who's sitting up there. I think it's risky for the Republicans because these states and cities and counties are desperately in need of that help. And if they're opposed to it, if the Republicans are opposed to it, that could be turned against them. Could.
Rosemary?
Hey, so I think that Democrats and maybe the media are getting all hyped up over this move by the attorney generals for nothing. I think it's a really valid question they have. The law is written quickly, and this item about the taxes was added at the last minute. It's not well written, and it is fuzzy. It says if you're going to use our money, you can't lower taxes. But there are many states, including several that are in this group of new attorney generals, who had tax cut ideas on the way. They were in debate or they had been voted partially through. And what happens to them now? I don't know. It does seem to me that it would be that they're not qualified for the aid. So I think they're actually completely legitimate in asking for clarification. I think the threat about if you don't do this, we're going to contest it is kind of obvious. It's kind of cranky. It's still obvious. And that this is a matter that Democratic lawyers and lawyers for the administration should be looking at and figuring out the rules and laying out. And then we move on from there. I don't think this is a big deal.
Chris?
Yeah, I agree 100%. Rosemary said almost exactly what I was planning on saying, which is that I actually think they're raising a valid point. Local legislatures and local city councils and town councils have the right to raise or lower taxes. And if this somehow overrides that right, I think they are raising a valid question. I mean, the idea of using some of this money for tax cuts has been raised here in Albany, even. It's not just a red state thing. There are blue states that have been looking at using the money that way. So I do think they have a valid point.
Malia.
Yeah, well, I agree they have a valid point, but it's telling that it's only Republicans who are raising this point. There's the valid point, but then there's also the disingenuousness of why they're raising it in this way. And, the states receive all kinds of federal money that's specifically stipulated and can't be used for tax cuts. And they don't complain about getting money for Medicaid and education and infrastructure. And so I think certainly there's a, while they have valid question, there's a lot of political grandstanding going on as well.
Yeah, but I think this is fundamentally different than money that is targeted for a very specific use is one thing, but this money is kind of, there's a lot of discretion for how local governments can use this money, and money is fungible. So it's very hard to say we're not cutting, we're using the money for this and cutting taxes over on the other side without running afoul of, potentially running afoul of the legislation.
Yeah, I think Chris makes a good point. The motive of the Democrats in adding this was to make sure that money intended for relief did not go to further the Republican agenda of cutting taxes, of making government less visible in states and in people's lives than it has been. And so I think the Democrats are right to want to stop it, but you have to do it in the right way, in the same way that we can see that Trump could stop immigration if he wanted to, but he had to follow the laws and the rules, which he did not. Why would Democrats be exempt from that now? Part of being bipartisan is you accept the adversarial nature of the Republicans. And when they have valid criticisms, you don't just say, oh, it's partisan and we hate you. You say, oh, yeah, you have a good point. Let me fix that. And I think that's what Biden has to do right now.
All right. Anybody else on that?
Well, you have to get it through both houses of Congress. It's easy for Rosemary to say, well, I think that's what Biden should do right now. But he was able to get the thing through.
No, that's not true.
Wait, I don't think I'm quite through with what I was saying. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I don't think you're right. The law is through both houses. It is a law. And now
that's right.
We've moved an agenda, which is the courts. And it is up to the Biden administration, not him himself, to say, okay, yeah, you need some clarification. Here it is. That is part of being bipartisan, is that, yes, we're going to make this work for all the states.
You certainly kid when you say this is part of making this bipartisan. What in the world would make you think, Rosemary, that there's any interest on the Republican side other than being obstructionist to make this a bipartisan effort?
I do not think that, and I don't think it matters. Joe Biden promised to be a president for all people. And citizens themselves have responded to this bill highly favorably. That's why Biden's popularity ratings are so high. It's why the popularity of this bill is so high. People like it. And so now it is incumbent on him to make sure that it can work, even when there is obstructionist tactics by Republican attorney generals.
Well, I certainly agree with the last part of that. It is obstructionist, and we know it's obstructionist, you know. So just say, well, the president can snap his fingers and make it better is not the way that this government works and this policymaking thing works.
I'll play back the tape, but I don't think I ever said snap his fingers. I think Biden recognized.
No, I said snap his fingers.
All right. Let's.
You meant snap his fingers. Go ahead.
All right. Let's go on and move on to other subjects if we can. And we certainly can. All we have to do is move
snap
on.
Your
snap your fingers. That's right. So let's talk about. Russian election influence this morning. And the news from what we learned yesterday, that Putin targeted people close to Trump and bid to influence the 2020 election. That, according to U.S. intelligence, Russian President Vladimir Putin and other senior officials in Moscow sought to influence the 2020 election by spreading misinformation and misleading information about Joe Biden through prominent individuals, some of whom were close to former President Donald Trump. That, according to the intelligence community in a report yesterday, the report does not identify those individuals by name, but it appears to reference Trump's one-time personal lawyer, say it with me, Rudy Giuliani, whose repeated meetings with a suspected Russian agent came under scrutiny by U.S. officials. Both Russia and Iran sought to influence the election, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said in its report, but a third major adversary, China, did not try, it says, contradicting the Trump administration's assertions about Beijing's activities last year.
The question I have for you, Joe, and everybody else on the panel is, if Trump had been reelected, right? If Trump had been reelected, would we ever seen this report?
Well, I mean, great point. I mean, we certainly knew.
I think we might have. Can I just?
Yeah.
Because Trump's own director of national intelligence, came out and said publicly that there, you know, this is a couple of years ago, but he said that that there had been Russian interference in the 2016 election or attempts to interfere. And so I think, you know, Trump is so good at trying to discredit things that he probably, he just has discredited the intelligence community since even before he became president. And that certainly didn't stop while he was president, and it wouldn't have stopped if he had continued being president. So I don't think he would have been worried about this report being released. He just would have continued with the same kind of obfuscation that was one of his chief strategies.
Well, just to fight back on that a little bit, you know, I think that we really wouldn't know what would have happened. Obviously, you're right about that, but and you're right that the national security agencies did raise voices about what was happening, even though Trump was in some obvious denial about the whole thing. But what's really good about this is that Nancy Pelosi, who said all roads lead to Trump, lead to Biden from Trump. It was exactly right, and we knew it then, but now we're knowing it in capital letters.
Chris?
It's a good question about whether we would know this information if Trump had won, but I mean, I think Trump would probably be highlighting and may even be highlighting the fact that Iran was apparently working to elect Biden or trying to help elect Biden. You know, it's not, this information yesterday wasn't just about Vladimir Putin. It was also about Iran, although the China part of it is interesting for sure. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I read it wrong. I thought that the accusation was that Iran was working with Russia
Iran's supreme leader, I'm going to mess up his name, so I won't say it, approved a digital scheme to undercut Mr. Trump's reelection bid, the declassified report said. You know, which is not surprising. I mean, countries do this. We do this stuff all over the world, as Rosemary could probably tell you with her experience in you know, the Middle East and other places. This is, to a degree, what countries do. I think what we saw in 2016 might have been a little bit unprecedented, but, you know, this is hardly a new idea.
Rosemary?
Okay, so what I took away from this report is, yes, I'm really glad it's public. Two is that it does give a brand new look on China, different from the Trump administration. He kept trying to blame them, and there's very little evidence that China did anything. In fact, it's so eager to stabilize its relationship with the United States, they seem to have stayed out. And Iran was involved, but in a really kind of clumsy way. It was easily detected and not very effective. It is Russia. It has always been Russia that we ought to be concerned with, and that Trump never was. But what I really got out of this is, why is Rudy Giuliani not indicted? What happened to Lev and the other? What happened to all of that? We knew a whole bunch of this. There's apparently further evidence that we didn't even know about, and yet there is no apparent ongoing investigation. I guess maybe they are, and it's all secret. But anyway, Lev and Rudy are still running around free and apparently in the clear. How has that happened? Are we really going to just try to move forward and forget about all this?
It's a great question. Lev Parnas and the like. Go ahead, Chris.
I just say, you know, I think Russia's attempt this time was pretty clumsy, too. I mean, I think spreading information through Rudy Giuliani.
There you go.
Thank you. Is not exactly, you know, the
we'll edit that out. Don't worry.
Way to spread misinformation. And it's worth noting too, the report also found that Cuba, Venezuela, and Hezbollah were also trying to influence the election in various ways. So,
Malia,
I think it is interesting that, as the report points out, China considered but decided not to try to interfere, and I think that's partly a result of the fact that the Biden administration's policy towards China in a lot of ways isn't actually that different in content from the Trump administration, because one of the few areas in policy where there is bipartisan consensus right now is that China is our major national security competitor. The Biden administration has already released its initial national security guidance Defense Secretary Austin, Secretary of State Blinken are in Asia right now, their first trip they're taking jointly. They're going
to
be meeting with some of their Chinese counterparts tomorrow in Alaska.
I have to pause you there. I'm so sorry.
Sorry.
We just have to get to a news break, and we'll be right back, and you can finish your sentence, I promise. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Our last round with the group, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Chris Churchill. Before we went to break, Malia Dumont was in mid-sentence, and I had to cut her off so we could get to news in time. So I give you the floor, Malia, to finish your thought.
Yeah, sorry for running on like that.
No problem.
Everyone in the foreign policy establishment knew that the Biden administration was not going to take a softer approach towards China than Trump did. Now, Trump was very mercurial in the way he interacted with Chinese officials, but I think Biden has sort of come out swinging. His first major foreign policy speech last month was about China. And as I said, the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State are in Asia right now meeting with allies. And I think that's, you know, China knew that, just like everyone in American foreign policy establishment knew that was going to happen. So that's probably why they didn't see any real benefit in trying to interfere in the U.S. elections. I do want to make one other point that's related to this, given other tragic news today, which is that it's important for us to keep in mind these are competitions between nations, right? Not between peoples. And the wave of violence and discrimination against Asian Americans in the United States needs to stop. And there's no reason to suspect the patriotism of anyone of Asian heritage or any immigrants from China. You know, we have lots of students at Bard, for example, where I'm very proud to work, who are from China. And we're very glad to have these kind of people-to-people interactions and educational exchanges. And all that is incredibly important and needs to continue. This great power competition between the United States and China should not translate into bad relations between people.
You, of course, are talking about the 8 killed in shootings at spas in the Atlanta area, where 8 were killed and 6 of those were Asian women. A suspect was arrested. Chris, you were going to say.
I think Millie raised good points on all throughout that. Obviously, right, we're talking about nations, not types of people, you know, and it is important to remember that. And she's absolutely right that the report actually says that China decided that neither administration was going to be favorable to it. So there wasn't much reason for it to try to influence the election. And beyond that, it was afraid of being caught and what that might mean. You know, the risks really outweighed the rewards for China, which obviously Iran and Russia and some of the other countries didn't feel was the case.
Rosemary?
I what can I do except agree? I think that's what both Chris and Leah made points that I agree with. The hate crimes in this country is an ongoing, horrible blot on us. And I'm not sure what to do about it, although I am sure that the removal of Trump from office will help.
And Alan.
Oh, I don't know. I pass.
Okay. You started the round, so it's fine.
I
wanted to give you a right to reply, but that is fine.
Thank you.
Let me go to, let's see, we have about six or 7 minutes, so let's go to another story here as we finish out our time together. And we go to this, which is, I say we go to this. There we go. Darn it. 1 second. I apologize. My internet is being wonky. We got a nice note from Virginia Hodson, by the way, who we celebrated for her birthday, and she was very thankful. So We thank her back. Here we go. My goodness. I love this story from the New York Times about the incomplete wall. The pictures are just priceless. So, I mean, the whole thing is a tragedy, of course, but it's just insane looking at it. The Trump incomplete border wall is in pieces that could linger for decades, is the headline in the New York Times. A last-minute rush to build lasted through Trump's last day in office. The effort left odd, partially completed sections of a barrier whose fate President Biden must now determine. And if you get a chance to look at the pictures, they're just, again, it's a sad, sad story of how much money was spent on this. But it's just like a stretch of fence and then miles and then like this little chunk and then nothing. And now people are just going down to take pictures of it and to take a look. There it was, this unfinished piece of completely pointless wall right in this magical place, Julia Sheehan said, a nurse and former Air Force mechanic who trekked to the site with three other military veterans who are hiking the Arizona Trail. It's one of the most senseless things I have ever seen. It's just like this quarter mile fragment of the wall, which is part of an array of new barrier segments around the border. Alan.
Yeah, you know, we know that this was a pure...
I apologize. The one thing I just wanted to mention is So $15 billion is what we paid for what we have currently. Go ahead.
So that's what it was all about. It was all political. It was all that he wanted to make the point to keep those out. And he spent $15 billion to do it. It was crazy. We all knew it was nutty, loopy, but we did it. The country did it because he had the resources to make that happen. It was disgusting.
Rosemary.
I too was fascinated with this story, and I'm really eager to see what comes out of the review of the wall. He harmed the environment. He built these pieces of walls in places that were the most pristine and scenic and beautiful. He's increased the chance of erosion by digging out mountaintops and by actually increased the chance of smugglers and human trafficking by building roads in places where it had been inaccessible before. It's so damn mean-spirited what was going on right up until and on January 20th that it's just unspeakable to me. I want him to undo this. And I guess he has to make a decision, he and his Homeland Security and the Department of EPA maybe, on what the cost would be to either just leave it as it is or to make fixes or to just reverse it. What a terrible chapter in American history. I can see this being tourism in the future where people will go to see Trump's folly wall. Crazy. Just a blot.
Chris?
So in my head, it kind of amuses me to juxtapose some of Trump's rhetoric, especially in the 2016 debates, you know, the Republican debates, where he would talk about how the wall was going to be huge and beautiful and Mexico was going to pay for it. And, you know, whenever somebody asked a tough question about the wall, he'd declare that it was going to be, it just got 10 feet taller or whatever he'd say, you know. And then to juxtapose that with this picture of this pathetic looking little fence that like anybody could just walk around, you know, in about 10 minutes. It's amusing. Although as you said, Joe, when you talk about the money spent and some of the implications for it, it's really not that funny, but it really is a pathetic looking little thing. And it's also bizarre. You would think that they would have a starting point
and an end point.
And an endpoint, but it's just in the middle of nowhere. There's just this little.
I can provide some insight into that.
Please do.
Because I actually, the picture, the story in the New York Times, Coronado National Memorials, actually, it's right down the road from Fort Huachuca, where I did a lot of my Army training. And I used to be a volunteer at Coronado National Memorial on the weekends. And I did a couple things there. I would band hummingbirds, because it's a major migratory bird flyway, which is fascinating. And I would also pick up trash. There's a lot of trash from all the migrants who had come through. And where that section of wall is built is right where one of the major paths used to be. I have a picture of myself. The old fence used to be two strands of barbed wire. That was literally the U.S.-Mexico border, right where you see the picture in the New York Times. I have a photo of myself standing there. But the other ridiculous thing about this fence, besides the tragic fact, as Rosemary pointed out, that all the terrible environmental destruction. I mean, this is one of the most ecologically unique and diverse areas on the continent, that area of Arizona, the Sonoran Desert. But also, in order to build this fence, they had to disrupt or remove some of the other measures that they used to use, the border patrol used to use to see where migrants are coming across the border. There were, there were underground sensors. Those are much more effective for tracking where people are coming across. And if your goal is to try to prevent people from crossing the border, using sensors to determine where they are is a much better measure or tool than putting a fence up. And so they had to dig up a lot of those sensors in order to put the fence up. So it's just counterproductive from what Trump was trying to do.
But I have a question for you. How did you get your hands on them?
The hummingbirds?
Yeah. I mean, we got hummingbirds.
I can tell you that it's the short story is it's basically you put a tent around a feeder and the sides of the tent are raised and you sit 10 feet away hidden holding a string. And when the hummingbirds come to the feeder, you let go of the string and they're sort of inside the tent.
And then you reach in?
And you're able to safely grab them. There's a hummingbird monitoring network that I joined. And you could get literally clouds. Sometimes we would get 10 hummingbirds at a time.
Wow.
Do
they bite?
Really beautiful and fascinating.
Do they bite?
They don't bite. I never was harmed by a hummingbird, and I never harmed one either. I can say we would measure them and feed them, and then they would fly away.
I must say
little band around their leg.
Listening to you do this just makes me feel like the most insignificant human being on the planet. Good for you for saving our hummingbirds.
I feel like we wasted the last 2 hours. We should have been listening to hummingbird stories the whole time.
Absolutely.
That's why I'm brilliant. I heard it and I jumped on it. I said, that is really interesting.
My blood pressure just reduced just listening to all that.
It's a lovely story. Yeah, and we only have less than a minute, but then what happens to them? Once you've monitored them and tagged them, then they're off on their own again?
They're off on their own, and each tag has a number, and sometimes they get recaught. And these hummingbirds, they migrate from Alaska down to South America. They're amazing little creatures.
They really are. Mm. Well, that's very, very cool. All right,
and there are far more species of them out west, I should say. We're only used to the ruby-throated here. There are 7 different species of hummingbirds you can see in Arizona.
They're beautiful. My thanks to everybody, and what a great way to end. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Malia Dumont, I thank you all for being with us. We are out of time, but we'll be right back after this.
And we thank you, Joe.